So actually, you could easily say that John Greenwald Jr. has been tangled up in Project Blue Book since he first started to try to get government documents back when he was a kid, starting at 14, filling out FOIA requests. God bless him. It led to a great website, The Black Vault. If you haven't seen it yet, go see the primary docs. That's what I really love about this research. You see the primary material that you're not just getting, a derivative material. You can go read the memos at the same time as you're reading his new book, which won't be out until April. The book is called Inside the Black Vault, and he talks a little bit about his relationship with these searches for FOIA material, but also goes in and using the very same documents which the government claims proves its case that there is nothing to these investigations in Roswell, the Project Blue Book, and yada yada, that you can go look at the very same documents which the government presents to say, see, nothing here to look at. And he uses them right back at them to say, see what you're missing. That book won't be out until April, as I mentioned, but we get a sneak peek at it, and it's only appropriate with this hot new show on History Channel, Project Blue Book. We'll talk about it next with the author on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, you're a good man, John Greenwald Jr., for agreeing to come on, even though your new book isn't available for purchase yet, except for pre-purchase, which you can click on through if you go to coasttocoastam.com. And I'm a fan. I really enjoyed what you were doing here, especially with the amount of research you did for Inside the Black Vault. So thank you for giving us time tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
But there's scant information in your biography available to me. So I want you to fill in a few blanks. I mentioned how early you got onto the whole FOIA thing. I thought that was really cool. While other kids are having lemonade stands, you're trying to, wrestle government documents. But tell us a little bit more about you starting at that age to where you end up now.
Sure. Well, like you said, I started at the age of 15,
No.
firing off FOIA requests. And the quick backstory to why I started doing that, which I'm sure we'll probably talk about at some point in the next 3 hours, is the amount of information that is out there. And I'm not talking about just government documents, but about UFO stories. And even back in 1996, I was amazed at how much information was on the internet. Now it's, 100,000 times over what was on back then. But I was amazed by it, and I wanted to know more. And I've said it once, and I'll say it again. It was kind of like the stupidest decision I ever made, but it was the smartest choice I ever decided to, do,
Right,
where I
sure.
thought that if somebody was going to tell me the truth, it would be the United States government. And I really thought that at the age of 15,
And you should
because,
think that at 15.
well, young and naive as I was, but I honestly did, as silly as that sounds, and that's why I started with the FOIA was I thought, okay, let's just go after the heart of this. I mean, you read these stories on the internet, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do it as well, where they Google search something and you get lost in the rabbit hole of going through millions of web pages that you can choose. But how do you know what to believe and what not to believe? And so when I started going after the documents, I thought, okay, this is going to be verifiable, which is, still true. But the information within it tells an amazing story of a cover-up, of lies, of deceit. I mean, and it spans decades and decades, and there's no way around that. And that's what got me interested very early on, because I realized very, very quickly that I was getting documents that shouldn't exist. So if you believe what I call, and thank you for mentioning the book, what I mention in the book is what I call the company line. And so what I mean by the company line is the government wants you to think a certain way about UFOs and what they are and what they aren't, and that's what they want you to believe. And it's all based on Project Blue Book and their investigation and their determination. And as a 15-year-old kid, that was what they first sent me. They sent me these fact sheets and, this is what you're supposed to believe, John. But I didn't really believe it. I just had a kind of a gut feeling that there would be more, and I went after it, here we are more than 22 years later, and not all on UFOs, but I've amassed about 2.1 million pages of declassified documents on any government secret you could probably dream of. I've got probably documents on it or went after it. And here we are. So I run the blackvault.com, and ultimately that is what I've done for 22 years of just researching
except
what the government has and what they don't have.
Except, John, that didn't give me more biographical information about you. Like, where did you go to school? Like, what did you? Yeah, I know, but it's like, that's exactly, it's like, I know what you're doing now, and I know that's where you started, but there's a little gap, a little knowledge gap in between. I mean, so what was your academic background that gave you, because I mean, Roman and Littlefield is no, that's not an insignificant publisher. They publish mostly academic work, and then there's the trade books that they do involve themselves with have to have some level of gravitas to it. And they don't just publish anything. They don't do romance novels. They don't do a lot of stuff. So they clearly see the value in the amount of research that you've done in helping to define an argument here. But where did you get that skill? How did you come to being able to collate all of this material and become an archivist?
Well, honestly, I taught myself. I mean, at the age of 15, when you're taking, you know, high school classes, you know, I was a sophomore in high school in Mission Hills, California, at a high school named Alamany. You can't say, hey, I want to take a class on the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, it just it doesn't exist. And while I was supposed to be reading Richard III in my English class, and this is a true story, I'm not exaggerating. I was supposed to be reading Richard III. I was literally sitting in my class handwriting Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA. And I remember one time I did get caught, that they were wondering, like, what are you doing? Because the Black Vault, although was around back then, I mean, it wasn't anything of what it is today. So I got in trouble, you know. I mean, I wasn't focusing, and I know my parents are listening, and they're probably laughing because, you know, school suffered a little bit because I started focusing on what I wanted to learn, and in you know, the history classes that you take, and this also plays a role in why I do what I do, in the history classes that you take in like a high school prior to college, you know, you blow through like a World War II era in you know, 40 minutes. It just deserves so much more. Like, history is so much more valuable than that. And so that's what I was doing, not only with the UFO information, but again, I was going after everything as the months and years went on after I taught myself how to do this thing. And so through high school, I just kind of continued learning, figuring out what to do. If I had patience for school and was better at it, maybe I would have went after a law degree or something like that. But I actually didn't pursue anything. I other than, you know, researching, archiving, putting it all online. I got into television production as a quote unquote day job because I was doing a lot of on camera stuff for, you know, being interviewed for History Channel and Discovery Channel. I fell in love with the way that television was made, so that became a career. I'm embarrassed to say, but I'll say it. I didn't go to college. I went for about a semester, and it wasn't for me. I mean, I had kind of found what I wanted to do, what I loved doing, and what I needed to know. I taught myself and kind of took the next step. And so that day job became ultimately for many years a television production. So I was producing and writing and directing. And then during the night, I was, you know, firing off FOIA requests and mailing them off to the CIA and the FBI. And so that was kind of, it was like a double life. So when you say that there's kind of a hole in my biography, that's true. I mean, I don't talk about that a whole lot, just simply because, you know, I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed. I'd love to tell you.
Don't be embarrassed. You know, no, don't be. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. In fact, you are probably a typical of the person who might not benefit from a college education, because you're a self-directed learner, and college can become superfluous for somebody who has the inner discipline to study and create their own life major, as it were, and a minor. So you were majoring in archiving, and you were minoring in television, and you did just fine. Did you end up being involved in any way, or preliminarily even, in discussions about this hit TV show based on Project Blue Book?
Not the drama, no. I've worked on a couple that have been, just based on the hype about it. About a year ago, I worked behind the scenes on some documentaries that may air later this year on networks like the History Channel. I can't go into great detail on the networks yet because I'm not sure if there's going to be an air date for them. But I did work on that, but I did not work on the drama series that's getting all the hype now
Right.
on the History Channel. I did work with them publicity-wise, and interviewed the creator, David O'Leary, and had fun, kind of picking his brain and just
Right.
talking to a fellow producer who obviously is very passionate about what he does. It is a dramatized series, obviously, and I asked him
Yeah.
about that, about accuracy and, how much did they follow the truth and so on. And, I have mixed feelings. It's a fantastic show in the sense of production value, and they have an amazing cast and so on. I
Yeah,
just always want a
Littlefinger
little
from
bit
Game
more
of
accuracy.
Thrones.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, we're talking about some big name actors and
Yeah.
actresses in this, those that you would recognize. So for History Channel production wise, it's fantastic. I mean, it really is. Then I take my producer hat off and then put my, UFO researcher
Right.
hat on, and then cringe a little bit because, in my opinion, truth, for the most part, is a lot stranger than fiction, and you don't need that drama. I mean, sadly, from a production standpoint, yes, you do, but for me anyway, a historical standpoint, you don't need it. So I cringe a little bit. I mean, I wish they stayed a little bit more accurate than they did. But hey, it's out there. It's getting people watching and hopefully interested in the subject, and it's fun to watch.
Well, so and it wasn't I think I appreciate your candid response. I had a similar reaction when I watched it was the things that they decided to dramatize, I had no frame of reference for whether it was accurate. I just suspected that it wasn't based on what little I did know. And it, particularly when it comes to the personality of J. Allen Hynek and how he developed over the years. And I think that is being well represented, that people may not be aware of, that he was originally brought on by the Air Force into the nascent stages of Project Blue Book as a debunker. And he was perfectly willing to play that role because he personally didn't believe, as an astrophysicist, that there was anything to this notion of unidentified flying objects, that they were all going to be easily explained or just dismissed, if nothing else, which he did
Yeah.
a lot of.
And for me, that is one of the biggest takeaways from the Project Blue Book, what I call the Project Blue Book era, getting away from the show a little bit, but more on
Right.
history, that I don't think people really realize, in that arguably he was a scientist, true scientist, that looked at more UFO cases than probably almost any other scientist out there. And he went from that skeptic to believer. I think people largely miss that, because a lot of scientists today, and I don't want to point fingers, but those that are known to be more skeptical about this whole phenomena, and I do say it plural because I think there's multiple aspects of it. I always get
Sure.
letters when I say phenomena, but I say it intentionally.
Well,
But
you
the
would get
scientists,
letters if you didn't say it. Somebody would still
I mean,
rightly complain. You can't win on that, so don't worry
No,
about
you can never win in
it.
general,
No.
but so the skeptics, today, and the scientists today, they don't look at cases. I mean, they have an overall view of the topic, and their points sometimes are very valid, but they didn't do the research that he did. And so when you look at somebody, a man of science, that looked at thousands of cases and the evidence, and he goes from, hey, this is nothing, to, hey, this is something.
Right.
To me, that's amazing pivot for somebody of his stature, and I think it's something that we should look at. I don't care what the government ultimately concluded or the military ultimately concluded. What I look at is, the people that were looking at the cases, namely, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, that he walked away from that saying, this deserves more scrutiny. This deserves a closer look. And he goes on and he creates his own UFO research organization. That to me is an amazing foundation for UFO research that now, moving decades beyond that era, it does deserve a closer look. We still don't have answers as much as the government wants to tell us that they have them all. We really don't. And I think that their own government documents, even post Project Blue Book, prove just that, that there's much more to this story.
Two things about what you said strike me. First is the numbers, the sheer numbers. You mentioned that he had investigated or been a part of, overseen something in the area of 12,000 reports between the earliest time he was brought in. I think, what did he start, about 1948? Is that what he was brought in originally?
Yeah, I know it was the late 40s. I don't know exactly what when he
roughly
did, but yeah, he came in around then.
And left about left Project Blue Book in 1969, and in between that time, there's about 12,000 cases, and the 95% of them were explainable by, you know, human error, confusion, some normal astronomical case, like, you know, Venus was particularly bright that night, or other things, a plane flying overhead. But it's that 5% of the 701 cases, and that number always stays with me, 701 cases, which they had no explanation for. And if you think about that, when I know you do, that's a staggering number. I mean, 5% of the case. If we said, what, there is one proven case of one crashed spaceship in the middle of a you know, old-fashioned American town, if we said there were one, it would change history. But 5% is so bigger than that. And for some reason, people find ways to contextualize that as though, you know, it's probably going to be nothing. It's probably just, you know, they couldn't find an answer, but there would be one out there. They just haven't found it yet. Instead of the other way around, which is scientifically, there is no explanation. As a scientist, J. Allen Hynek determined they were out of explanations for 701 cases between 1948 and 1969. And that is that's the pivotal point for him, I think, and how he starts to view this as a scientist.
Yeah. And I liken it to the research for, let's say, the cure for cancer. And if you do 12,000 experiments, but only a couple hundred show promise, are you just going to give up and say, wow, forget it? I'm guessing a cure doesn't exist. No,
just
of course
a few.
Not. From a scientific standpoint, that deserves closer scrutiny, and that deserves a bigger look. And I think that when you look at it that way, because some people just dismiss it and go, well, it was only 701. Well, I mean, let's just even cut that number in half,
right,
and say that half of those just didn't have the evidence, but they were weather balloons or, you know, the planet Venus,
right,
or swamp gas. That's fine. But again, it like you said, it's only one. It only takes one. It only takes five. And I think the Project Blue Book, albeit is a little bit dated at this point, just simply because there's a lot more beyond Project Blue Book. And that's what I kind of learned. I don't want to say the hard way, because but it was the hard way where I had to look for it.
Right.
There are documents even post Project Blue Book that should not exist, that blow the cases, in my opinion, out of the water when it comes to the fascination behind this all, and really the unexplained nature to these cases, that they actually weren't during the Project Blue Book era. They came after. And through the Freedom of Information Act, that's when I started extracting these reports and cases that, again, the company line said, hey, Project Blue Book did all this. 12,000 plus cases. We don't want to investigate this anymore. And yet there's reams of material after Project Blue Book that shouldn't exist.
Well, we'll get into that coming up in the next half hour. But what you just said speaks to that other thing which J. Allen Hynek had as a takeaway, which was that derision and scorn, ridicule, had no place in science. That this was a false response, that was a non-scientific response. It was non-informative, non-probative. If the reaction of scientists were just to dismiss something because it seemed unlikely, and or to mock the people who were involved in a particular story because it seemed so extraordinary, that was not scientific. And he looked at himself, he reflected back on himself and said, I was guilty of this. And now that I recognize that, I'm calling out on all other scientists to stop it, and to just realize that if we're going to be true scientists, we have to accept without using derision, without using ridicule, we're going to have to accept that we don't have an answer and that that in itself is significant. Well, stand by. We'll get more with John Greenwald Jr. in just a second. Inside the Black Vault is not available yet for purchase, but it is available for pre-purchase. So that way, when it comes out, it'll show up in your box. And you'll be like, oh my God, look at that. I forgot I ordered this. What a gift to yourself, to the self of the future that will be receiving that. You can pre-order it tonight. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. We'll get to more next. This is Ian Ponet. All our bumpers have a theme tonight. It's all about Blue, Project Blue Book for our guest, John Greenwald Jr. He's giving us an inside look at Inside the Black Vault, not coming out until April, but you're getting a sneak peek on it tonight. And you can also, well, I'll ask him about this coin. There's a kind of a cool little side hustle to this book, which he'll explain here in just a moment. But I want to get to some of those stories that come out after they closed the canon on Project Blue Book, but also his work, John Greenwald Jr.'s work, in finding the very same documents which the government says, you see, there's nothing to see, that he says proves exactly the opposite. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet. John Greenwald Jr., Inside the Black Vault, who is not just an author, but he's minting his own coins. So explain this piece. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I wanted to do something a little different, just with the theme of, well, everything that I do. I always like to do it different. And, you know, a lot of authors will create a T-shirt or bumper stickers or bookmarks or something. So I mean, you can buy the book by itself. It's not mandatory that you buy this. But I created a challenge coin, partly because of the history behind what challenge coins are. Now, they actually date back to ancient Roman times, where military personnel were given these coins to commemorate an achievement, maybe in the military or something that they've done. And that has kind of spread throughout the decades and the years to not only the military service, but beyond it. And so I created a coin, a challenge coin, because it really goes to the heart of why I do what I do with the Black Vault, and that's to challenge people to discover the truth. And that's been a catchphrase literally since day one for the BlackVault.com. And so I put it on this coin and made this coin to kind of commemorate the release of this book, because obviously it was a lot of work to put together. It's 22 years of my own research, but it's really over 60, 70 years of government documents and research. I mean, I take you on a journey through pretty much every government agency. And so I set up a website to pre-order. It's inside theblackvault.com. You can see a picture of this coin. But again, it's a symbol of what I really have been motivated to do for the last 22 years, and that is to challenge people to discover the truth, because the truth is not always what it seems. And I go back to that company line that I was talking about, that the government wants you to believe certain things, or people want you to believe certain things. All you have to do is ask the right questions and look at the evidence and realize that it's really not the truth. And so so I made this coin. There's only 500 of them. Each one is laser etched with its own number, 1 through 500. And once they're gone, they're gone. And it's just, again, kind of a fun symbol to go along with the book.
Well, John will be back on when the book is released. I think the date has already even been picked in April when he will return with George Norrie. And you'll have a chance then to drill down deeper on many of the other chapters of the book. I'm focusing kind of on the first part because of its pertinence with the popularity of Project Blue Book. And for that matter, Roswell, New Mexico, which is a new series that started on the CW. I haven't seen it yet, but George was talking about it. So, and I was just there too in Roswell, New Mexico, a couple of months ago, first time I'd driven through the town. And I it stays with me, especially the story as you describe it in the book. In your earliest chapters, you were curious about certain things, and that's a pretty good example of how the government would send people who asked for more information about Roswell. They would send them documents that were full of facts, or data anyway, presuming to be facts, but it was the frame that they were putting around it. The government was putting around those facts that this, see, this proves there's nothing there, when in fact you saw it exactly the opposite of that, including that famous photo of the crash test dummies. Explain that.
Yeah, Roswell obviously is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the company line. And why I bring this up is that the government wants you to believe that there was nothing to the Roswell incident, and they've done not one, not two, not three, but actually four big published quote-unquote explanations of what the Roswell incident was. And their newest, which was published, and I say newest, but it was published in like 1997, I believe, which was the Roswell report, case closed. And so what I do in the book, using only government documents and verifiable information, is take what they want you to believe about Roswell. And what they've done is they take hundreds of pages that are in this book, and they make what's called an executive summary. So it kind of takes all those hundreds of pages and shrinks it down. So you have, you know, your choice of two things to read. So I took the bullet points from that executive summary of what they say the Roswell incident was, and using only their own documents, and using only history, I completely blow it out of the water. Now, I didn't aim to do that when I, you know, started this research 22 years ago. When I was given that, you know, you see the thickness of the Roswell report, case closed, and you go, okay, you know, I mean, we know the Titanic sinks at the end, so I don't really want to read it to know that they're going to tell me that aliens aren't real and nothing happened at Roswell. So when I was looking at these bullet points, I went, well, wait a minute, some of this doesn't make sense. And so I started researching, and it's as silly as this. They tried to explain the bodies, and I'll talk about the dummies in a second, but they tried to talk about the bodies that people saw, that the witnesses saw. So people like, you know, Stanton Friedman and everybody who's researched the Roswell incident and all of these witnesses, that they were seeing injured pilots. But the problem was the incidents that they were explaining happened like 9 and 12 years after Roswell happened. So everybody was having like this time warp distortion that it wasn't 1947, you know, it was in the mid to late 50s on when they were seeing these bodies. I mean, there's like blatant errors like that, and including the crash test dummies. That was another point, another bullet point, that they said if it wasn't the injured pilots, so that was kind of zeroing in on the witnesses that saw bodies at a hospital or on a stretcher or whatever. Then they said that that the you know body explanation was also these crash test dummies. So what I did was I researched what was the first crash test dummy that was ever created, and it was created by Alderson Research Labs. And the earliest reference that I can find is 1949. And so obviously this is years after Roswell happened. And why such a huge discrepancy with the history, just like basic fundamental research when trying to explain Roswell, yet nobody just seemed to fact check anything. And so that to me was such a blaring mistake. And again, using just their own information, you can blow their explanation out of the water. So then my bigger question with Roswell is, then what exactly is it? If after, from 1947 now to 2018, they have not been able to adequately explain it. There's some cool history that's come out, like the Project Mogul balloons, like what that actually really were, trying to listen for Soviet nuclear tests. I mean, that's really cool history. That has like nothing to do with what happened in the deserts of Roswell, in my opinion. And the reason I say that is after all these years, even if it was super top secret, in my opinion, something would be able to come out to kind of explain that at this point. Now, am I comfortable saying it was absolutely an alien spacecraft? Well, I don't know that. But what I am saying is that the cover-up when it comes to Roswell is so blatant and careless. You can't help but think, hey, wait a minute, there is something way more interesting than what they want us to believe on this. Then the question becomes, what is it?
So, you know, there's a piece to this, too, which you hint at, and I would just drill a little deeper on the idea that the those crash test dummies are articulated and life size to a grown human adult. And that was not what was reported in 1947. What was reported was not human size victims, but rather, you know, more closer to a child size victim.
Right.
So even that was kind of a weird discrepancy, because unless you assume everybody's really stupid or that they somehow had their brain bulk erased the day before, when you see the crash test dummies, if you didn't know it was a crash test dummy, the first thing you would say by association is, oh, it looks like a window department store mannequin. You
right.
would just say, oh, it looks like a mannequin. And if people at the time in 1947 would have said, and there were these mannequins that were lying all over the place, why do they think that people would suddenly not know what a mannequin was or be able to not make the association, as you do in the book with the clear photograph of what the crash test dummies look like? They look nothing like child size aliens. They look like somebody that you might see in a JCPenney, you know, in a blazer and, you know, posing with a pair of loafers or something. It isn't right. I mean, there's just nothing about it that looks alien. It looks human, and it looks actually fairly mundane, like something you would see every day. Why did they think we wouldn't make that connection?
Your guess is as good as mine. And that's what I was so impressed, maybe the wrong word, but surprised by, that the government really thought, hey, let's just throw this explanation out there and see if it sticks.
Yeah,
you know, and the fact that it didn't stick, no one cares. And that to me was so surprising, was that they really did think that they could pass this off and that people would believe it. The one that got me was, and there were the two aircraft accidents where they were trying to explain the quote-unquote alien bodies at the Roswell Army Airfield. The two incidents was one in 1956, which was a KC-97 aircraft accident, and 11 Air Force pilots and members were actually injured or were killed during that. And then the second was a 1959 mishap with a balloon. That, to me, in my opinion, was even more ludicrous than the crash test dummies. And when asked by the media at the time, hey, wait a minute, like there's a time discrepancy here, the Pentagon pretty much just said that they felt that with all the years that had passed, the witnesses that were talking got their dates wrong.
Right.
All of them.
Right.
You know, and
simultaneously.
So I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what frustrates me more, the fact that the military tried to pass that off, or that the media just said, oh, okay, we'll take that as it. Because, like, no one really ever followed up. No one cared, and so this explanation has stuck ever since. So what I did in the beginning of the book was just take their company line, what they want us to believe, and again, just blow it out of the water. And it's a lot easier to do than you might think. And when you start to really start dissecting each of these cases and each of these eras with Roswell and Project Blue Book, I mean, I put up a pretty big case that Project Blue Book was not an investigation. But rather the intent was an explanation. So there's nothing scientific when you have an agenda. And when you have a drive to disprove something, there's nothing scientific about that. You either prove or disprove it. That's why you do tests, and that's why you do analyses, and you try and figure out what's really going on. But what I really discovered with the documents going then beyond Roswell and into Project Sign and Grudge, which were the precursor names to Project Blue Book, and then in 1952 and Blue Book, quote-unquote, officially started through 69, you look at all the case files and you realize that they really just did have an intent to bring the statistics down on the number of unexplained cases. So they wanted to slap explanations on these cases, and they wanted to just dismiss them all. And for me, the icing on the cake, and I wrote about this in the book, the icing on the cake for me was a batch of documents found by a researcher, not by me, but his name is Rob Mercer, who saw on Craigslist an advertisement in the Ohio area, which is by Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, of, and this was just in the last 5-6 years, I believe, he saw an ad for old Project Blue Book original documents that were found in a garage. Now, it kind of sounds like a scam, but he did extensive research to realize it was not only real, but he tracked down the military officer. It is verified he was part of Project Blue Book, and he had saved, because they were going to the trash, and that's key, and we can talk about that too.
Right.
But he saved these things because they were going in the trash. So he brings them home. They sat in his garage. They collected dust. He moves. The new people that move into the place find these documents. So they just slap them on Craigslist. And Rob found them, tracked down the military officer, and he actually had more. Now, when you look at these documents, they are not in the original, most of them are not in the original Project Blue Book files in the National Archives, which is where now they claim everything is. I've disproven that, but that is what they have wanted you to believe. And so he received these things, and I worked with him, and we got them all scanned, and I've got them all on the blackvault.com if anybody's interested. But when you look at these things, you realize that they really were trying to explain everything. And in it were correspondence letters between Dr. J. Allen Hynek, originals, and Hector Quintanilla, who was towards the latter end of the project, the head of it. And Hynek was pushing to go back on the explanations that even he signed off on to some of the earlier cases,
right,
to go back and have them reevaluated. And the whole point, what I'm trying to say, is this was an inside look to show that it was like Hynek realized that they were just slapping explanations on cases, not for scientific reasonings, but rather to bring those statistics down. And so, you know, I'm kind of summarizing everything, but there is a big case with a lot of supporting evidence to show that this was not a scientific investigation, and that their quote-unquote conclusion is not founded on anything. I even found documents in this, or excuse me, Rob did, but we've got them digitized, in that there was a military officer in Florida who was calling enlisted airmen who were seeing UFOs imbeciles and jerks because they reported a UFO. They didn't do anything else, mind you. All they did was report a UFO because they saw something strange. And this ranking officer wrote this scathing review, even wanting these guys, I believe he recommended court-martialing anybody who wants to report UFOs anymore. And Project Blue Book was still going on. This was not like a waste of time post-Project Blue Book. They're just, you know, wasting resources. This was during the investigation, and military personnel were being called imbeciles and jerks. And all of that was in this information. Now you know why it's going in the trash, because they didn't want anybody to see this type of material and how Project Blue Book was handled. So I dissect a lot of that, because it really was the icing on the cake for me. Even though my mind was kind of already made up that Blue Book was just an explanation, it was the icing on the cake that said, hey, look, these guys are not only trying to explain these cases and close the book, so to speak, on it, pardon the pun, but on top of that, they're trying to cover up what really their mindset was. And
you know,
that was just to explain and not investigate.
This parallels a catalyst for J. Allen Hynek that we know of, which was that he took a private survey anonymously of 40 top astrophysicists or astronomers around the country. And he asked them to describe for him, again, no repercussions to their reputation, just yay, nay, fill in the blank, whether they had had, and what did it look like, an encounter that they could not explain with something that was aerial, something that was in space or within the atmosphere. And the of the 40, I believe it was 11% of the 40 reported that they had seen aerial phenomenon that they could not explain, which scientists had found bothersome. And he determined that that was actually at 11%. That was a higher rate than the public at the time, that the acceptance rate of a potential UFO was higher amongst the informed, educated elite than it was with the general public, which was less than 10%, maybe closer to 5%, who were willing to accept UFOs. Mm. And so he thought that was kind of a turnaround moment for him. where he was like, okay, these are people who do this and they're afraid for their own reputations, just like the soldiers were going to get stigmatized. In his case, he knows that these people would be resting, you know, risking tenure or risking, you know, the loss of a publishing contract because they seemed, you know, quote unquote, kooky. But privately, they would tell him what they would not say publicly. And that's where we'll hold it for now. We'll come back with John Greenwald Jr., the author of Inside the Black Vault. Book does not come out until April, but you can pre-order it. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. This is our chance then to pivot, John, after the top of the hour. We'll talk about some of the cases that have come out since then and your work with the FOIA to find out more than the government would tell any of us. But you had the patience to keep digging and to keep sending out the requests until you got a response. And we'll tell more about that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.